And my collaborators for some part of this work are a couple of other assistant professors at UCO, and James Bullock and Arvind Rajaraman, and a postdoc, Luis Trigari. Okay, so since most of you are probably not cosmologists, I'm going to take our first few slides and actually start slowly. Okay, so the case for dark matter actually goes back a long way. It goes back to this crazy wiki, who in 1933 actually looked at the Coma Cluster, saw that the velocity dispersion of the galaxies were way too large, and claimed that there was dark matter in the universe. Okay, and then in 1937, in another very crazy paper, which in English is just one column, he said that the best way to detect dark matter would be to look at gravitational lensing. And I think that is the best way that we now have to detect dark matter on small scales. What actually cemented the case for dark matter on galactic scales was actually Rubin and Ford, when they looked at the Andromeda galaxy, the closest one to us. Pretty much all the pretty pictures we see of the spiral galaxies are Andromeda, who essentially said that if they look beyond about 4 kpc, they see that the velocity rotation profile doesn't fall off, and they infer that there is dark matter in this galaxy. Okay, so that's on small scales, like galactic scales and cluster scales. And we also know from a bunch of experiments, and I'm not going to go into this at all, just put up this plot, so there's, you know, clusters, CNDs, supernovae, that they all seem to claim something like 30% matter. And then if you add PBN, CNB, or some other set of experiments, you find that there's about 30% matter and only 4% is baryons. And so on even on cosmological scales, the case for dark matter is pretty solid. Okay, so a standard theory for dark matter is actually these WIMPs. Yeah, there's also the axions, but their phenomenology is pretty much the same as the WIMPs. So, and WIMPs are basically weakly interacting massive particles. They're a generic class where they freeze out when they're not relativistic. Okay, and I'm going to use two things to describe WIMPs, and I'm going to use them because this way I can contrast what I'm going to talk about later with respect to WIMPs. The first one is the free streaming length. Okay, so this is essentially those scales below which you see no structure. Okay, and this is really set by the interactions of the WIMP. So they're weakly interacting, right? So they're maybe, let's say they're 100 GeV mass, so when the temperature falls to a tenth of that mass, they annihilate away. Okay, but that's not the end of the story, because they are in the plasma and they're interacting with the plasma, right? Just like neutrinos interact weakly. And so typically they kinematically freeze out around, depends really on the supersymmetric model you consider, but typically on 10 MeV, it could be as high as 100 MeV. Okay, so essentially, if you calculate the velocity at that time, right, and multiply that by the horizon of the universe at that time, that gives you the free streaming length, meaning all perturbations below that length scale are wiped out. So that sort of sets your smallest mass halo that you can get out of it. And if you calculate it, it just turns out that it's around the Earth mass. Okay, there's actually a wide range here. It can go from 10 to the minus 2 to maybe 10 to the 4 Earth masses, or something like that, 6, 7 orders of magnitude, depending on how exactly, when exactly it decouples. Okay? So, but still, something like an Earth mass is the smallest halo. Of course, it's not very clear whether these Earth mass halos will survive, right? Because they're all in bigger halos, and typically they get stripped. A recent simulation by Ben Moore's group has shown that at least they seem to think that these Earth mass halos will survive, which means you should see a nearby dark matter should really be in the form, at least a good portion of it should be in the form of these Earth mass halos, right? And phenomenologically, that's very interesting in terms of like dark matter detection, stuff like that. So this is going to be different in the story I present. The second thing about dark matter, about CD cold dark matter, I'll characterize it as through its phase space density, okay? And its phase space density, I'll just use this definition, which is where rho is the mass density, that's mass per unit volume, divided by its velocity dispersion to the three halves. So this is sort of like mass per unit volume, well, per unit phase space volume, so that's why it's a phase space density. And if you calculate this number for some typical WIMP, which freezes out around 10 MeV, it's some humongous number in these usual units. Solar masses per parsec cubed, per kilometers per second cubed. Okay? And this is just telling you that the WIMP is very cold. Right? The density is fixed by cosmology, and then V squared is very small, and therefore this number is huge. So one way to think about cold dark matter is to just say that its free streaming length is very small, and its phase-phase density is very large. They are in principle two different effects, because in the free streaming length, it's the mean velocity that matters, and here is the velocity dispersion. So these are sort of like the first two moments of the distribution that you're using to characterize this cold dark matter. And these two are going to be different for the case I'm going to talk about. One more slide on cold dark matter. The things we are interested in are sort of the halos of dark matter, how dark matter clusters and forms nonlinear structures. And simulations predict that these halos have a density profile, so density as a function of radius, which is close to a universal shape. Okay? And for what's relevant, the density increases approximately as 1 over r at the innermost radius to resolve these simulations. That seems to be pretty much set now. Nobody's debating about, you know, 1.5 versus 0.5 or something. Everybody's converged around something like 1 over r, maybe 1 over r to 1.2 or something like that. So anyway, this is, as more and more simulations get done, people seem to be converging around here. Okay. And then finally, it's the concentration of halos is set by the mean dark matter density of the universe when the halo collapse. And that's a statement, I guess, about really what hierarchical structure formation. Okay. So how dense a halo is just depends on when it actually forms. So what I'm going to be interested in are dark matter particles from decay. Okay, and so the question really is, what is the dark matter we see today? Essentially, all came from the decay of some other massive particle in the early universe. Okay, and I didn't just ask this question. I basically heard some talks by Jonathan Fung and Arvind Rajaraman talking about this region of supersymmetric parameter space where the gravitino is the lightest Suzy particle. And it struck me that this is just as natural, and this is what they were saying, just as natural as having a neutralino as the lightest supersymmetric particle. And yet, it was bound to have very different cosmological consequences, which people hadn't fully explored. Okay, and so one model to keep in mind is perhaps the scalar partner of a neutrino decaying to a neutrino and a gravitino. Okay, so this is your WIMP that decays to a your gravitino, or you could have a star or something charged, and that'll be interesting. And the natural lifetime is around 1. You can fudge this by making the phase space larger or smaller, but essentially, if you put G Newton and MV, you get 1. So here's the picture. It's a WIMP decaying to a dark matter with some lifetime around 1, or it could be larger, depending on like really what the mass difference of the WIMP and dark matter is. Right. And so these WIMPs have essentially the right abundance for the same reasons, right? That typically you think of WIMPs having the right abundance is their little weak interactions. It's a weak interaction basically. And here you have the dark matter density today is the WIMP density multiplied by the ratio of these masses. And so if the masses are similar, then the dark matter that I'm thinking of now coming from the decay essentially naturally gets the correct abundance. And so you ask whether this is true, and well, supergravity models, all the superparticles have similar masses, so this is not hard to achieve at all. Right? So MVM is supported MWIM, and therefore this dark matter is just as natural as that one. Okay. It's just a matter of choice you make. A boundary condition at the gut scale, whether you pick that kilo to be the lightest or something else. Okay, so I'm going to recap before I talk about the cosmology. Basically, think in your mind about weak scale gravitinos, but also, this is true in extra dimension theories, the gravitons would have similar phenomenology. These things are not completely cold, as I will talk about, and they don't have a thermal distribution. It's not quite clear whether we'd be able to ever measure this distribution, but essentially there are two different effects that come from it being not completely cold and not being thermal. So this is not like the gravitino, which is considered by Pagels and Primer back in 82 as the warm dark matter. Because there they had KeV masses, right? And these were thermally produced. Okay, so why work on this? It's sort of, I wanted to ask myself, whether it's theoretically compelling and all that or not. And so here's a couple of reasons I listed. It's basically got the same reasons why the WIMP is a good candidate, dark matter candidate, right? There are strong theoretical hints of something happening at 100 GeV scale. The weak cross-section and G Newton now lead to the right dark matter abundance, right? And as I'll say, or I'll say it right now, is that the cosmological predictions on large scales, larger than a megaparsec, are absolutely the same. Okay, so there's no difference between this and a cold dark matter on large scales. For a huge region of parameter space. There are differences on the smaller scales, and you know, if I were selling this, I would be saying that you know, this might alleviate some problems with CDM on small scales. There are discrepancies between observations and CDM on small scales. It's not quite clear whether it's all due to astrophysics, gastrophysics, or something more fundamental. But it's interesting that we might be able to look on small scales and probe the differences. Okay. So in the second half of the talk, I'll just talk a little bit about the small scales. And just to put things in context, these two are the main points why we think of CDM as being the canonical dark matter candidate, right? It's just the fact that there's the weak cross section and some new physics at 100 GeV scale is really very theoretically compelling. And so they are the same reasons to consider this kind of dark matter. Okay, so how do I distinguish this from WIMPs? Well, as usual, there's always two ways. There's the accelerator searches and there's the cosmology. I'm not going to talk anything about accelerator searches. But there, this essentially, one way to do it is to look for long-lived charged particles, assuming that the NLSP is charged. Okay, and this is not an easy job, and there's some ideas around. It looks sound even like science fiction, like things like putting huge water tanks around LHC, you know, and some of these charged particles will eventually make their way into the water tank, stop there, then pump the water deep underground and wait for it to decay. Pretty neat stuff. Or there's other, you know, essentially looking for charged particle tracks in LHC. So that's really one way to go about it. In cosmology, there's a whole slew of things that happen, okay, because of this decay. Big bang nuclear synthesis, and I'll talk a little bit about this. The cosmic microwave background, so if you're decaying in the early universe and you're dumping in some radiation, for example, then you have to be worried about the fact that the CMB black body will no longer be a black body. You can only distort it by 1 part in 10 to the 5 and 4. Okay. And so this is a constraint. You avoid this constraint as long as the decay sort of happens before the temperature falls to about 10 keV or so. A KeV or so. So, you know, this just means you have to decay slightly early, or you have to make sure that there's no radiation that's produced by the decay. Okay, in the late part of the universe, you have small scale structure formation that you might use to distinguish the two models. Okay, so let me take you through one, something to do with big bang nuclear synthesis, and then I'll talk about small scale structure formation. So the early universe stuff, I already said that late entropy injection is going to distort the CMB black body. There's been some work on this, and you know, it sort of rules out lifetimes larger than 10 years or so. For the BBN, because this decay is happening and you're dumping in energy, you can affect the light element abundances, right? And you could destroy light element abundances, so you have to be very careful. That actually rules out a large region of parameter space, but there's still a huge region left open. And there's been some debate about whether it can solve the lithium-7 and lithium-6 problems. The lithium-7 problem is simply that if you take the CMB baryon density and look at the predicted lithium-7 abundance, turns out that the observations are higher. The theory is higher than the observations. Okay, so you might say, well, it's lithium-7, you destroy it in stars, what's the big deal? And yeah, you can easily destroy it in stars. The issue really is that the measured abundances have a very, very small dispersion. And so if you're going to destroy it by, let's say, about a factor of 3 in stars, you have to explain why the dispersion isn't large. And that nobody's been able to do. Okay, so there's this issue, which might just be some stellar physics, or it might be something else. And there's the issue with lithium-6, which is simply that in standard BBN, you produce next to nothing lithium-6. Okay, and so, but in in these top two halo stars, you actually see about 1% by ratio of lithium-6 to lithium-7. And so that's got to be explained. So there's been a lot of interesting stuff. I don't think right now anybody can say with confidence that these two problems are solved within the context of these models where you have decays. But as I tell you, there's a new critical in the argument. And what I'm going to talk about is essentially bound states of helium-4 of this charged MLSP. So all this while people have been talking about charged particle decays, somehow this was missed. Okay, and all of a sudden, in what, 2 weeks, there were 3 papers on it. So there was one by Maxim Gospelov, and I think I was skimming through the seminar series. He's going to talk about this later this month, I think. And there was a paper by Kohori and Takayama. Fumihiro is one of the original guys who proposed this super-wim scenario. And then myself and Arvind Rajaraman had this paper. And we all considered different effects of this bound state. Okay? And essentially what we are thinking of is basically atoms. But atoms of amazing electromagnetic bound states of helium and the charged NLSP. So imagine in your head that the charged NLSP is actually the star. Okay? That's very heavy. Right, it's 100 times the mass of the, let's say, the helium. So that's the nucleus, and the helium is the electron. Right, so it's a bound state with a binding energy of about 300 keV. Okay, so very tightly bound, and a Bohr radius of 3.6 fermis. Right, so the star is sitting sort of right outside the helium nucleus. The radius of the helium nucleus, if you use the 8⁄3 law, it's something like it's 2.5 fermis. So first of all, you know, it's this huge electric field sitting right outside the nucleus, and you can imagine it's going to change all your nuclear reactions and things like that. But the first order, you want to calculate when does this recombination happen, meaning when does this bound state form? Right? And given the 300 keV temperature, just from your intuition about how the photons, how the protons and electrons recombine, you might expect that somewhere around 10 keV, the recombination happens, and that holds up. Okay, so here's a plot of the fraction. So the solid line here is the fraction of stars. So if you think the stars are the NLSP, is the fraction of stars that are bound. Okay, so you can see that, you know, and this is some mass. I forget what it was. Maybe 200 GeV mass. You can see something like 20% of the stars are bound to helium. Okay. And the dashed line here, right, is the fraction of helium that's bound. So this is more important here. So it's about whatever it is. In this particular model, it's about 7%, but in other models, it might be a few percent. Okay. And this fall off here is simply the decay happening. So I put a lifetime which corresponds to some temperature here. Okay. So that's the decay part. Now, at some later time, so this is happening around, says 6 or 7 keV. At some later time, somewhere here, less than a keV, the protons will also get bound, the star. So you'll make neutral states, proton, star, neutral states. And so that's not been done by anybody now. That calculation of nothing. So I could have put another line here to show you how the proton recombines, which I've done. But just looking at all the nuclear reactions with all those neutral particles, right? Until it comes to within a few fermis, as far as the Coulomb barrier is concerned, there is none. Right? So the first order, you want to think it's like a neutron which doesn't decay. And you can imagine that can do things, that can do drastic stuff. The reason why it's not going to destroy everything is because it's happening so late. So the number densities are kind of small. Things are freezing out by now. Okay? But the helium star bound states happen pretty early, and this can have dramatic consequences. So this is the first thing to look at. Okay. So just imagine in your head that a few percent of the helium is bound. So the charge is no longer +2, but it's +1. Okay, so there's a bunch of things that happen. What we looked at was what happens to the helium when the decay happens. Okay, so when this decay happens in the bound state, and kinematically, it's not forbidden. The decay will happen because the energy difference is so big. So once in a while, the decay product, in this case, if you think of a star, the decay product will be a tau. Okay, so it's negatively charged. It's going right? Some fast-moving charged particle very close to the nucleus, and once in a while, it's going to break the nucleus, right? Once in a while, it's just going to kick the nucleus, but once in a while, it's going to break the helium nucleus. And so there's a relevant calculation that you need to do, and it's some problem in Heskin and Schroeder, and you do that, it's very approximate, really. It's, you don't really have any data for photo disintegration at these high energies, right? But you do it, and you find that the probability for photo disintegration is surprisingly small. I expected this number to come out much larger, because you imagine there's this charged particles going through the, you know, through the helium nucleus. It should destroy it, right? It doesn't always destroy it. And if you put in all the numbers, it turns out it's 1 in 1,000,000. So this seems like a small number, but it's not. And it's not for the following reason, that when the destruction of helium happens, the products that come out are helium-3, tritium, you know, deuterium, neutrons, and protons. Now these helium-3s and tritiums that are moving very fast can go and impinge on some helium nuclei lying around. And when helium-3 and helium-4 come together, they make lithium-6. And remember, in standard BBN, you have no lithium-6. Right? So anything you make is a very good way of probing this process. And so that's the process you want to look at. The decay products making lithium-6. Okay? And it's just a nuclear cross-section, not suppressed by anything. There's no Coulomb barrier as long as the energies are large. Right? But in fact, if that was the case, then you would just make too much lithium-6. It does happen that it loses all of its energy pretty fast, right? Because it's a charged particle in the plasma with photons and all other charged particles around. The first thing that happens is that it just degrades in energy really, really fast. Okay? There's a whole bunch of energy loss processes that you need to take care of. So you put all of that in, okay? And that tells you how the energy is being lost and what the probability for a nuclear interaction is. Fine. Now there's another process that's important, because all of this energy loss gets converted to non-thermal photons. Right? So these are photons that will eventually thermalize, but before they thermalize, they have large energies. And if you make a lithium-6, well, it can get destroyed. Right? If you have something like a 5.5 MeV photon floating around, it'll come and disrupt the lithium-6. So you have to worry about the lithium-6 getting destroyed by these non-thermal photons also. Okay, there's other processes to take care of, but at this point, I've only done these two things, to prepare the energy loss and the destruction for non-thermal photons. Okay, and here's the sort of result you get. Now, this is in the context of a very particular model. This curve will look different for different theories. What I have here is a star decaying to basically, in the supergravity models, you have a star decaying to a tau and a gravitino. Okay? And on the x-axis, I've plotted the lifetime in seconds. I'm going from 1,000 seconds to about a year. And on the y-axis, I have the ratio of lithium-6 to hydrogen by number. And this plateau here is simply the standard BBN plateau that I've put in. Okay. And then as the lifetime gets larger and larger, which means, you know, the decay is happening around the time when most of these things get bound, right? You see a sharp spike in the lithium-6 abundance, and then it falls down again. And this fall down here is my approximate calculation for taking into account the destruction by non-thermal photons. If the non-thermal photons weren't there, then this thing would just go off like that. And I've shaded this region as being green because this is the cosmologically interesting region. Okay, in these old Bob 2 stars in the halos, you see an isotopic ratio of lithium-6 to lithium-7 of a few percent. And lithium-7 to hydrogen is 1 part in 10 to the 10. So somewhere around here, right, 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 11, if you produce primordial lithium, then it's interesting. Okay? If it had turned out to be much larger, then you would start ruling these regions, this region of parameter space out. Okay? So this is what we did. And here's a Max and Postpiller actually looked at a different process, and it's very, very interesting. What he looked at was, so let me step back and say, why is lithium-6 produced in such small quantities in standard BBN? For people who do BBN, this is kind of known. It's basically the fact is that helium-4 and deuterium making lithium-7 is a very suppressed process. And it's more suppressed than usual nuclear processes with a photon in the external lens. Right? You would expect that to be suppressed because it's electromagnetic. Right? It's an electromagnetic particle. But this is even more suppressed due to some other nuclear physics reasons. So you make very little lithium-6. Okay. But what Maxine pointed out was that if you have a star sitting here, right, some heavy charged particle, that's like an electric field, a classical electric field sitting there, then you don't have to have this photon in the external leg. You can just have a star helium here. A deuterium comes and hits it, makes a lithium 6, and the star moves away. Okay. So in some sense, the photons absorb and you know, dissociates the bound state. Okay, so now there's no photon in the external leg. It turns out that this there's a huge enhancement. And Postolov calculated this and found that there's something like 8 orders of magnitude enhancement, which seems very jarring at first, but then he reminds you in his paper that it's basically this, it brings this reaction to the same level as all the other nuclear reactions without a photon in the external leg. Okay, so it's probably, you know, it may be off by a couple of orders of magnitude, if that, but it's still a huge enhancement. And so what I did was to take a cross section and plot what happens to the lithium 6 abundance. And he didn't consider the non-thermal photons. And so actually, if you take that into account, you see that most of the lithium 6 for a larger lifetime gets destroyed. But then there's this interesting region around here where things come out to be right. Okay, and more interestingly, I guess, depending on your, you know, whether you're a pessimist or an optimist, this region here is just ruled out, right? Because it just makes too much lithium 6. So that's great, because you can tell the people who do accelerated structures, don't bother about these kinds of charged particles with lifetimes, you know, somewhere between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 6 seconds. Okay. Now there's a few more things you need to take into account, but I believe if this thing holds up, then this region is definitely ruled out.
So you can come destroy it if you see it.
Is this kind of, yeah, I mean, it's a good question, but you know, I, getting from 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 11, it's just, you know, you would destroy it, but then you also destroy lithium 7. And clearly you don't do that, right? So that's just gone. This is already a big wide range. So if this thing holds up and my gut feeling is it will, then you know, then I think you ruled out this region of the space. And as I talk about, this is really the cosmologically interesting region of Perfect Space. It's just by luck. Okay. So it's pretty neat. And there's much more work that needs to be done in this. And so maybe in the next 6 months or so, we should have this thing worked out. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears now. So that was talking about BBN, and unfortunately, there's no, I mean, I can't tell you for sure that that region is ruled out, but it definitely looks like it has charged particles there. You have very severe constraints for small lifetimes, but for larger lifetimes, it's probably okay. Okay. And this region, by the way, here, greater than something like 3 times 10 to the 8, is anyway ruled out by CMB. So the lifetimes have to be somewhere here. Of course, there can always be a neutrino, a scalar particle decaying. So those, in that case, this constraint won't be applicable. Okay, so in the second half, I just want to talk about a little bit about the late universe stuff. So this was really about BBN and the early universe constraints. Can we use the late universe to distinguish these two kinds of models? And earlier last year, I pointed out two effects, one which is actually trivial and one which is slightly more subtle. So let me go through them one by one. The first effect is actually that these models actually have a large free streaming scale. So remember that the free streaming scale for CDM was such that the smallest mass halos was around an Earth mass. In this case, it's way larger. Okay, it could be 10 to the 6 solar masses, things like that. And the reason is that when the decay happens, so imagine you have a 200 GeV particle decaying into a 100 GeV particle. Okay, and let's say this is happening when the universe is a year old. Well, at a year old, you have a dark matter particle that has about the speed of light. Right? Because when the decay happens, if it's a 200 GeV particle going to 100 GeV particle, the speed, you know, the daughter particles get something like the speed of light, roughly. Right? And in a normal standard case, by that time, the dark matter would be very, very cold. Right? And so if it's a year old and you know it gets a speed of light then today it probably has 400 kilometers per second speed. That's like warm dark matter, right? Because CDM, I don't remember the number, it's probably like millimeters per second is the speed for typical CDM. Okay? So these things are going to look very different, and for some regions of parameter space, they're going to be just ruled out by large-scale structure data, because you can't really have very warm particles floating around. Okay, so the first thing is it has a very large free streaming scale. And the second effect is that, remember I said CDM has a very large phase space density. Well, this thing has a much, much smaller phase space density. Okay? And in fact, in those units where CDM had 10 to the 14, here you have things like 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 3, and stuff like that. Okay? And the smaller phase space density actually traces back to the fact that the velocity dispersion in this is actually much larger, for the same reason that the velocity is actually larger. Okay, it's a non-thermal distribution with a much larger velocity dispersion. So typically, in most for most distributions, unless you fine-tune things, v square average is bordered v average square, right, roughly. And here it's the same thing. And so the velocity dispersion here is actually pretty large, and so the phase space density is very small. Now, why is that important? It's important because this, as I'll try to show later on, first of all, you create halos with lower concentrations, so less dense halos, which are easier to destroy, and probably are more in line with the observations. And also, if you look on very small, for very small halos, you might see a flat density curve, meaning something where the density doesn't rise as 1 over r, but it goes up as 1 over r and it flattens off. Okay? And I'll try to argue why this is in just a bit. And this kind of effects are pretty natural in the super-wimp parameter space. So why am I interested in this less power and small scales and stuff like that? Here's a little bit of phenomenology. I'm not going to talk anything more about observations and things like that. But lesser power and small scales basically means less substructure of small scales. Okay, that's pretty much pretty well established now from simulations. Also, if you have halos with lower concentration, meaning they're less dense, or if you have halos where the density has a core, then they're easy to destroy because they're not as dense, and so when they come into larger halos, they get stripped more easily. And so they can be destroyed more easily. Again, going back to reducing substructure, meaning smaller structures in bigger halos. Another point is that lower concentration small mass halos are more consistent with two-dimensional rotation curve measures. So if you do take rotation curves of galaxies, it always looks like if you have less dense halos, they're more consistent. Okay, this is a true fact. I don't think anybody can argue with this. It doesn't mean that nature is telling us that these halos have lesser concentration. It could mean that we are really not interpreting the observations properly or something like that. This, because we look at the baryons and we have to infer something about the dark matter. So there's always observational biases and things like that here. So I'm not saying this argues or this definitively tells us that we have lower concentration halos, but it's a hint. Okay, it's something to keep in mind. What do we really need? I think what we really need are to look at these very, very small galaxies. Perhaps the galaxies in our own backyard, the local group galaxies. Okay, there are a bunch of them, about a dozen. And you know, you might want to look at the further ones in our own galaxy and then try to get velocity dispersion measures and see if these things have cores. Okay? In their senses. Because they are the closest ones, and they are the ones you can really go and you know put all the power of big telescopes on them and try to like measure the velocities of 10,000 stars, let's say, in these galaxies, and try to reconstruct what the dark matter potential looks like. So this is what we need here. Okay, so two things I want to talk about was the phase space density and the free streaming. So let me first talk about the free streaming scale. And really, one, the variable that you just have to remember is this Q, the phase space density. Remember, it was the mass density divided by velocity dispersion to the free house, V squared to the free house. And that's roughly something like 10 to the minus 3, but depending upon the parameters, it's going to be 10 to the minus 5, 6, or whatever. Okay. And for actually neutral particles decaying in the radiation-dominated regime, so lifetimes which are smaller than, what's the quality? I guess 10,000 years or something like that. So for lifetimes smaller than 10,000 years, this is really the only variable of importance. Everything is described by this just one variable, Q. Now, what does the phase space distribution look like? I told you it's non-thermal, but here's what it looks like. Q is just the momentum, but it's actually the co-moving momentum. So the physical momentum multiplied by the scale factor. Okay, let's think of it as a momentum. The phase space distribution looks like 1 over Q e raised to minus Q squared. Okay, as long as the decays are happening when they're non-relativistic. Okay. If you go to small enough Qs, then the decays become relativistic and things change, but it doesn't really affect any of the results. Okay, so basically it's a funny looking distribution, 1 over q e raised to minus q squared. And so that's why I call this non-thermal. And another thing that I won't really talk about it, I'll just put it up, is to compute the fluctuations in this, the perturbations, right? Because that tells us how the fluctuations grow. We need to figure out how the fluctuations grow, like in dark matter. In this case, it's slightly more, yeah.
So that's the initial distribution?
This is the distribution you get from the decays.
So after what is that time when this happens?
This doesn't change with time.
Doesn't change.
Yeah, it's like the usual thing. It's just set. Once the decays are over, it's basically set. All that happens is q goes as 1 over 8.
Q is equal to 8 times.
Yeah, so that's the only. So in terms of q, it doesn't change.
I thought that's only time dependent.
Yes, yeah, that's only time dependent. And when the decays are happening, there's a time dependence because you don't populate a mode q until a times pcm becomes of that. And this is the non-relativistic approximation. But that's very good because these WIMPs that are decaying are very non-relativistic when that happens. Okay, so the distribution phase, the reason I put this up is I want to point out two distinct effects. One actually which turns out to be very unimportant. The first part here, the perturbations, is exactly the same one that you would get if you had just a warm dark matter particle, meaning a thermally decoupled particle that has, let's say, a KeV max. It's that. That's just the free streaming of that particle. This here is just telling you that when the decay happens, the daughter particles remember the overdensities they came from. So H here is the overdensity. Okay? So imagine that, you know, there's an overdensity of WIMPs here and they decay, right? All of a sudden the gravitinos are moving with speeds of light, but they find themselves clustered like the dark matter. Right? It's a bizarre situation for the gravitinos because they're moving very fast, but when the decay happens, they're clustered like the dark matter. Right? So that term here physically is coming from that effect. Turns out they forget about their initial conditions pretty fast, and at the end of the day, it just looks like some, you know, massive part of the free streaming. Okay, so that's really the important stuff. And if you calculate what the free streaming scale is, it basically goes as 1/3. Actually, in detail, it doesn't exactly, but this is why I'm saying it just really depends on q. Okay, so roughly you want to think of the free streaming scale as going as 1/q⁓. Okay, forget about the other factors.
So it just looks like CDM but with a cutoff.
Yeah, exactly. So here's what it is. Basically, the dashed line is a CDM. This is just for some q is 10^-3 in those units. The cutoff happens at some scale which is around 0.1 megaparsec. Okay, so it's just basically CDM with a cutoff. And at this point, you know, it's really like a warm dark matter particle. And in fact, what I did was to show that there's a one-to-one correspondence between this and a warm dark matter particle. Okay. Except in the thing I'm going to talk next, in the way the phase space distribution comes about. But really, it's just a very well-motivated warm dark matter particle at this point. So the second thing I wanted to talk about was the phase space of this stuff. Let me take a couple of slides and just briefly go through the phase space arguments for collisionless systems. So maybe I was answering the question, but I just said this is the power spectrum. So it's the power spectrum of density fluctuations on a given scale, and k is just 1/scale. So this is small scales, that's large scales. Looks like CDM on large scales, doesn't look like CDM on small scales. So if you use observations of small scales, you might be able to distinguish it. And I'll talk about that right at the end briefly. Okay, so phase space, right? Essentially, for the fine grained phase space distribution, you have this Vlasov equation, it's just d over dt, the convective derivative of this is 0. If you like to think about, let's say, the phase space distribution of stars or something, of some particles, then all this says is if you hop onto some particle and move with it, then the phase space distribution you see around you stays the same. Okay, it doesn't change. And that's just what I said in words. One corollary to this, which is used all the time, is that F max is conserved, right? And that just follows from what I said. If you hop onto a particle around which the phase space distribution is the maximum in your entire phase space, then you're just transporting that maximum from place to place. Right? You don't change it. And this is true if the system is completely collisionless. Right? There's no two-body interactions that can scatter particles in or out. F max is conserved, and that's the corollary to that. And in fact, there's an infinity of conserved quantities. If you go back and look at this seminal paper by Lyndon Bell, he writes down the mass with, so for a given phase space distribution F, sorry, for a given phase space distribution capital F, if you pick some number F, then this just counts up the mass in all of phase space where F is larger than small f. This theta function just says big F larger than small f. So you just break up your entire phase space into cells, take, count up all of those phase space where the distribution F is larger than small f, and just sum it up, and it turns out it's a conserved quantity. And you say, well, this is infinity of conserved quantities. This is an entirely solved problem. What's the big deal? Why do people even run n-body simulations? So really, the problem is we never actually have fine-grained systems, right? It's always a coarse-grained system that you deal with. And unfortunately, that doesn't have a nice plus of equation. Everything really depends on how you coarse grade it. But what is always true, and this is what Gunn and Tremain exploited, is that the maximum of, the, of your coarse grain system, right, however you average it, has to be less than or equal to F max, right? In your fine grain system, if you have a maximum, I don't care how you average it. You never actually get a number larger than that. Okay? So if you have a warm dark matter with a Fermi Dirac distribution, you know that has a maximum. So Gunn and Tremain pointed out that there's a maximum to the phase space distribution. So if you make halos with, let's say, massive neutrinos, then if you go to the centers of the halos, you should see a flat core, right? If you don't, then your phase space density is going higher and higher, and it can't really because there's a maximum. That can never be violated, right? So this is a very nice equation because for a Fermi Dirac distribution you do have a maximum, but like I pointed out here, it's not quite the case. Right? So at first blush, it seems like we shouldn't really have any constraints, but that's not quite true because and one simple thing to do in your head is to imagine a Fermi Dirac distribution with a small delta function spike, okay, and normalize it such that the number of particles in that spike is very small. Now your F max is no longer small, right? But you know that at some level the same constraint has to apply, because if you make the number of those particles in that spike very small, then those cold particles will end up in the center, but they're a very small amount. Right? So it can't really change things much. So there has to be a better way to do it. And so the first way I'll give you to think about this is to think of entropy, right? Because entropy is log number of states. Right? Number of states is 1 over the phase space density. So therefore, entropy you want to think of as being 1 over Q, that Q variable we defined before, right? And so if you say that all halos form such that the entropy increases, then you can analogously say that all halos form such that Q decreases. Right? So that's sort of a way of generalizing that phase space, the Gunn-Tremain argument. It's not a very nice way to do things because entropy arguments always make you a little uncomfortable because what's to say that this halo didn't form with lesser entropy whereas the total entropy had increased, right? It's not a very rigorous argument. So it turns out when I was thinking about this, Walter Denon put out a paper which just thankfully happened around the right time, where he defined something called an excess mass function. So let me just define that in the next slide and I'll show you how I used it. What he defined actually is very close to what Lyndon Bell's M of F was. Right? Here it's the excess mass function D of F. Right? And it's defined as being an integral over all of phase space. And again, you only count up the cells which have F larger than this number here. Right? And you do that by, and you multiply it, so by F minus F. And that's where the excess mass comes in. Right. If I just have F, then that's the mass, really. But F minus F just accounts for the excess mass. Right? That's the excess mass function. Now, this function, turns out, has a very nice property. Okay. And people have, so this is analogous to the Boltzmann edge theorem, and people have been trying to do this for a long time, Tremaine and a bunch of other people trying to do this. I think this is first, something like this was written down by Samir Mathur first in 88. But unfortunately, nobody had ever written down something that, you know, if you, that was insensitive to the way you average, so that was insensitive to the way you get the closed domain function. But this one actually is just a five-line proof. I won't go through it here, but you can easily show that this function d has to always decrease in, you know, when there's mixing for every value of f. It cannot increase if it's a collisionless system. Okay, and by mixing, I just mean, you know, you take a bunch of like micros, you know, divide your phase space up into small cells, and then, you know, if you just average over some phase space cells in time, space, however you want to do it, that's mixing, right? And turns out that this d of f is has to always decrease. And if there's no mixing, it's conserved. Right? So it's a very nice function. It has these properties. And so now I can sort of use it like entropy. Okay? And I can use it like entropy because there's actually a direct analogy where the change in entropy can be written as just the change in this excess mass function integrated over all values of f. Okay? So excess mass function decreasing is sort of like entropy increasing. Whereas entropy is just one number, excess mass function is a whole function, right? So typically the constraints you might expect are stronger. For a warmed up matter particle, it's exactly, the constraints are exactly the same as that F max constraint. Okay. So how do we use it? Well, one way to use it is to, here what I've done is I've plotted the excess mass function as a function of this phase-space density F. Okay. They're all normalized to some units, doesn't it? For the discussion here, it doesn't matter. So this is just the number f, that's d of f. The dashed line is the excess mass function for the, you know, the f of q I wrote down before, the 1 over q e raised to minus q squared. So it's the excess mass function written down for the primordial distribution. This solid line here is the excess mass function for the parameters for a particular galaxy. It's actually a small galaxy in our own local neighborhood. It's called Sculptor. Okay. Don't think I put down the details. Anyway, the bottom line is that for any halo, right, take the halo of any galaxy and make d of f, it has to be such that at every point, d of f for the halo is smaller. Okay. Though that I'm not saying I know exactly what the d of f is. It could be here. There could be some halo formation, galaxy formation process that makes the halos with much smaller d of f. All this argument tells you is that it cannot be larger. Okay? And in particular, what this tells you is that in this particular galaxy, there has to be a core, because if there wasn't, you would, you know, you would cross this line somewhere. So that's sort of a generalization of the Gunn-Tremaine bound to sort of arbitrary phase-space distributions. Okay? And in this case, it tells you that small, you know, you basically have to have a core. In large galaxies, that core is unobservable because it'll happen at very, very small scales. But in small galaxies, and, you know, depends on the parameters, maybe it's like, in this case, it's 10 to the 7 solar mass, right? It's an observable core. Okay. So that those are the two effects I wanted to talk about. One was basically the free streaming, and the second one was this effect where you make a core, a flat density core in galaxies. So the last few minutes, I just want to touch upon one variation to this theme, and then I'll wrap up. Let me not go through these satellite problems here. So there's one more thing. Well, there's one more constraint you have to worry about, and the constraint is that you need to be able to reionize the universe early enough. Okay. In particular, the new WMAP data tells you that a reionization should have happened around 10 or so. Why is this important? Because if you have a power spectrum that's cut off, that means that, at least in this hierarchical scenario, that means that structure formation happens later. It happens, but it happens later. Okay. So there's a problem here that you may not form structures early enough, meaning you don't form small halos early enough, so baryons don't collapse early enough, so you don't make stars early enough. And that means you won't reionize the universe. Okay. And so that's a constraint you need to take into account. Problem is, it's not a very hard constraint that we can put now because this whole formation of the first star is not well known. Right? So I won't talk, let me not talk about this, but what I want to just briefly touch upon is another constraint, and that comes from looking at the Lyman alpha forest. So this is small scale stuff here. These are Lyman alpha forests, so they're basically like columns of neutral hydrogen. You can measure the, the Lyman alpha spectrum and infer something about the density fluctuations, and that tells you about the power spectrum, the density fluctuations on small scales. Scales of order of megaparsec, or maybe even smaller. Okay? And so, if you have a power spectrum that's suppressed, that's different from CDM, you should be able to like maybe tell it apart. Right? This red line here is the power spectrum of CDM. And it's sort of plotted opposite to normally what you're used to in cosmology talks. But now you're plotting large scales here, small scales there. So that's the CMB. And this is from Max Tegmark's website, so you can download it from there. That's clusters, gravitational lensing, and here's Lyman alpha forest. So I told you that at least in the case where the decays are happening very early, less than thousands of years, 1,000 years or so, there's a one-to-one correspondence between warm dark matter and the dark matter from early decays. Let me not go into how exactly you make that correspondence, but there is one. And so we can use already published limits on the mass of warm dark matter to put constraint on Q. Okay? And roughly, what the status before, I guess when these papers came out, were in March or April or something like that. Before that, the status was that Q had to be larger than something like Q times 10 to the minus 5. Okay? This was for the most recent. But then recently, there was new analysis and new data from Sloan, and especially Sloan data. Data at higher redshifts, which Selyak et al. Used, and actually said that the limits are a factor of 5 better. So they said that the mass of the warm dark matter particle has to be something like 2 keV or larger. That turns out it pretty much rules out the simplest stellar neutrino warm dark matter scenario. Okay, and so it's pretty interesting constraint. And in terms of Q, I haven't really calculated it, but it would be Qs of 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so it rules out some reasonable regional parameter space, supersymmetric parameter space, this data. I think there's going to be more work on this to make sure that all the systematics are accounted for and things like that. But it's an indicator. It's very promising. So the last part is just this question that we asked ourselves after these data came out. Remember I said that the cutoff in the power spectrum was directly related to Q as 1 over Q to the 1/3. So the question we asked ourselves is this relation between the power spectrum suppression and Q fixed? Right? Because basically, if this thing goes through, then it'll be very hard to distinguish these models based upon looking for cores and galaxies, because the cores will happen on very small scales, maybe tens of parsecs or something like that, which is going to be very hard to look at. Okay? So the question really is there a different phenomenology where the power spectrum suppression is not directly related to this Q? And the answer is actually very simple. And so here, I'm just showing you old Lyman alpha data. They were sensitive to this kind of scales. But now that this has moved up here, so it would be ruling out some of these models. So it's just one slide to explain it. Really, there is a difference between the decays that happen in the radiation-dominated regime, so lifetime smaller than something like 10,000 years, and lifetimes larger than that. And the difference comes because this here is sort of the sound horizon. This is the sound speed multiplied by the horizon of the universe. Okay? In the radiation-dominated regime, its scale is 1 over Q to the 1/3. And that's why the cutoff in the power spectrum is just 1 over Q to the 1/3. Doesn't depend upon lifetime. But if you calculate this in the matter-dominated regime, turns out it goes as 1 over Q to the 1/3, 1 over lifetime to the 1/3. So now I can make Q very small, which would mean large cores in the dark matter halo, while at the same time making lifetime larger and larger and making the power spectrum suppression happen on smaller scales. Okay? So why jump through these hoops? Two reasons. One, This has been something very cherished in cosmology, actually getting a cold dark matter like power spectrum, but at the same time getting cores and galaxies. Okay, and here's a concrete way to do it. Two, it's there in the parameter space. What do we have to do to get this phenomenology? Well, you have to fine-tune the masses of, let's say, this neutrino and the gravitino to be very close to each other. So delta M over M has to be of order 10 to the minus 3. So there's it's like the neutron to proton mass difference. Okay? It's certainly...
When you make the lifetime larger, then you have the BDN.
No, because it has to be neutral, stuff decaying. And then also because you make the delta M over M so small, the hadronic branching ratios become raised because you can't go through the W's and Z's, right? So basically the electromagnetic part of it is the branching ratios are really small. It's probably smaller than 1 part in 10 to the 6. So basically all the constraints go away. It can't be, you're right, it can't be charged because you would screw up everything. The power spectrum would be suppressed all over the place, right? So that's an important point. It has to be a neutral particle. I don't know if I've written it anywhere here, but it has to be a neutral particle. It can't be a star. It has to be a neutrino that's decaying this late, or some other neutral particle, maybe a neutralino. Okay. So the main idea here is make lifetime large, keep Q small, and you do that by, at least in these models, you do that by making delta M over M smaller. Now you can do that also in these split supersymmetric models, where you have long-lived gluinos. But there, when the decay happens, I'm not quite sure how much of a constraint that is on, because there will be a hadronic part. So you have to worry about those things. Although it's happening so late in the day, things are frozen out. Maybe it's okay. In any case, the making the lifetime bigger is just a matter of something making your phase space delta M over M small. And so we call this meta-cold dark matter, because it's really like cold dark matter. It's born from cold dark matter, and when it's born, it's non-relativistic. So by that token, it should be called cold, and it's meta just because it's coming from the decay of something. It's a new thing. So the scenario simply is some NLSP decaying to this MCDM plus a standard model particle. The energy of the decay products is around a GeV, imparted momentum to mass is 10 to the minus 3. It basically, it's a different phenomenology. You can get a phase space density for 10 to the minus 6 with a power spectrum that looks like CDM. So here's a CDM power spectrum, the black line. Here's a dashed line that has a Q of 10 to the minus 6, but the decay happens with sort of the natural lifetime, a month. And this is the new laminar rotator rule is out. Okay? In fact, even the old ones ruled it out. But here's the same one with the same Q, but a lifetime which is 10 to the 12 seconds. And now this is marginally consistent with the new laminar rotator analysis. Okay? So that's what it does. It changes things by orders of magnitude here, the suppression. So that's the message, linear power spectrum like that of CDM. But small dark matter halos have cores. Yes, it's interesting phenomenology. And this is the last thing, plot I have. This is just the ratio of the power spectrum to the CDM power spectrum. So it just shows you the suppression, and there's a power of half, so it's really the transfer function. So that line there is CDM. These two dotted lines, I don't know if you can see from the back, are the two recent analyses of Sloan Laminar for data. Right, it's basically one is Whale et al., one is Celiac et al. You can clearly see that there's differences here, so it's you have to wait on the verdict here. This thing is probably going to change in the next year or so. And here's that this dashed red line is basically this one, Q of 10 to the minus 6 and something like 10 to the 12 seconds. And if you push the lifetime to 10 to the 14 seconds, here's what happens. Completely consistent with the laminar rotator. And this, I've talked to at least a couple of the people who did the laminar alpha, and neither of them claim that there's any hope of pushing this any further because of systematics. This is probably as good as laminar rotator is going to get. Okay, and so here's just why we use meta. It's just got everything to do with metamorphosis, changing, and things like that.
So those aren't measurements, those are limits, right?
Those are limits, yeah.
There are limits on how, the power spectrum is still consistent with lambda CDM.
Oh, that's
on. how much it could deviate from it.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make. I'm sorry, you get lost in this, but yeah, really, the power spectrum is completely consistent with CDM. So you can't really deviate too much from CDM. And so this is really just telling you how much deviation you can have. And so, see, this tells you that there's a suppression by a factor of 10 on these fields. So you know, it's sort of, it's very sensitive to that. Okay, so there's a bunch of stuff I want to go into. Let me just wrap up here. This one interesting thing is, this is my last slide before my summary. There's too many codes here. So if it's a, forget about the thing. So if it's a neutrino decaying into a gravitino and a neutrino, right? So the neutrino, let's say the decay is happening at a redshift of 1,000. So now the neutrino has energy of 1 GeV, roughly, at a redshift of 1,000. So today it has an energy of MeV. Okay? Turns out this is actually detectable, right? Because Super Kamikana actually looks at these neutrinos. Right? So here's a plot of all the stuff that they can look at. This is the neutrinos. I guess this is the background from the solar neutrinos. And here's the background from the relic neutrinos from all the supernovae added up that have ever gone off. This is some background in Super K. This is some extension of Super K that will reduce the background by this much amount. And this is atmospheric neutrinos. So it turns out that for this Q to the equals 10 to the minus 6, right, if it's a neutrino decaying to a, so a scalar neutrino decaying to a gravitino and a neutrino, you get an effect which is right around here. Okay, so it actually, the super K bounds on, so the limit is that the flux is smaller than about 1 per centimeter square per second of these neutrinos at energies around 19 to 30 MeV. So that already puts limits on these kinds of things. It's very interesting that you know you might be able to see those neutrinos in the future if this process happens. Anyway, so let me just wrap up by saying that it's a pretty interesting phenomenology. It's just as well motivated as WIMPs, but it's, you know, it's got all of these different cosmological, astrophysical implications. So thank you for your time.
Basically, for most of people, consider gravitino velocity instead of the neutrino velocity. So there are 2 points here. First, unlike the neutrino velocity, there is some dependence on the thermal history of the universe. Because in order to get all of the dark matter from the NLSP decay, you need to make sure that all other sources of gravitino production, which are many, are kind of self-dominant. So there is some dependency here. And second, if you have like a positive signal in direct detection experiments, basically the LSP gravitino is ruled out. But I can imagine that you can reverse the role of LSP and LSP. So you have like an NLSP gravitino and some neutrino LSP, and probably most of the things will go through for that, like late decays and so on.
Yeah, I mean, so, well, I mean, I agree with all 3 points. The first one is basically, yes, that these are the gravitino LSP case. So if you were to reverse it, actually the constraints on gravitinos decaying and during DBN is actually much, turns out to be pretty strong too. So some region of parameter space is ruled out by the BBN constraints. There's actually kind of sort of slightly different BBN constraints on that. But in principle, yes, it could have neutrinos coming, all coming from the decay of the gravitino, then the same phenomenology applies. But that's, yeah, so that can happen. Second thing is, I didn't, in the paper I talk about this, but I didn't really mention here that, you know, in principle, there's something coming from reheating, right? Just the thermal production of gravitino.
Thermal production, many sources, you know, direct decay, many sources for gravitino production. So it very much depends on the thermal history. For the neutrino, the nice thing is that as long as you reheat the temperature above freeze-out, basically all previous things are completely...
Yeah, but there's only one thing it depends on, not many other things. It just depends on the reheating temperature, really. After that, nothing will decay to the gravitino. It will really decay to something else and finally cascade down to the gravitino.
Sure,
so that's fine. Yeah, but so yeah, you're right. So it's... But in that sense, it's really no different from asking why is the wind density what it is.
Right.
Right, that is also, in some sense, then dependent on these kinds of processes. Right. So, yes, it does. You have to make the reheating temperature below your usual 10 to the 9 or GeV or so. Otherwise, you overproduce the gravity. What if you had those kinds of gravitinos? Well, they would be cold up, right? So in principle, if you wanted to put the reheating temperature right around 10 to the 10 GeV, you could have a mixture of cold and hot and warm. But so yes, it does depend upon that. But then that fine-tuning, actually is a good point. I should put this up because, in fact, turns out that that's actually an argument for gravitino LSP. Because typically, the upper bound on the reheating temperature is like 10 to the 6 GeV or so. For the case where gravitino is not the LSP, because the BBN constraints are so much stronger.
That's where the hydraulic
is. Yeah, but because the BBN constraints are so much stronger on the gravitino decay. So if you look at most of the recent analysis, the reheating temperature is around 10 to the 6 GeV. But in this case, you don't have to worry about those things, right? And so, in fact, it's just the production of gravitinos. If you just look at the thermal production of gravitinos, then the reheating temperature is more like 10 to the 9 GeV. So in that sense, it's actually less worrisome because the reheating temperature can be higher. But that is an important point. The most interesting thing is, if you see something from the centers of the galaxy from annihilation, then you clearly rule out this gravitino, which is cool, right? Because when you see this, you've ruled out like a whole region of supersymmetric parameter space. Unless you have something like these split SUSEs, where you could have gluinos decaying to maybe neutralinos.
But the gluinos are not much anymore, so they're going to cost you.
Yeah, has anyone done it for these? I haven't seen any analysis for these very late decays and stuff like that, so I don't really know. I mean, I would imagine naively that they're much more constrained. But in principle, you could have that. If you're fine-tuning everything else, then you can have a neutralino being the lightest and a gluinos decaying to the neutralinos later. And so, in the natural region of parameter space, if you see something from the centers of galaxy, why would you consider this? There's a much more natural explanation, which is the WIMPs. Thanks. Those are all.
Thank you.